You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Jonathan Horwitz of Justice Initiative will be moderating Jameel Jaffer, the Open Society Fellow's presentation today on litigating drone strikes.
Great. Well, thank you and welcome, everyone. It's a pleasure to introduce Jameel, who's exceptionally well-placed to talk to us today about the U.S. government's secret drone program or campaign. Drones, code word, or the common phrase used for unmanned aerial vehicles, seems to be in the U.S. media almost daily. They've been the topic of recent hot political debate in the U.S., at least when it comes to the issue of targeting U.S. citizens. And they have been the tool that operationalizes and perhaps makes possible the U.S. government's increased willingness and appetite for using lethal force abroad, especially in places where it doesn't want to put its troops on the ground. Jameel will talk to us about the drone program in more detail and discuss the ACLU litigation that, for lack of a better term, has targeted the program. Jameel will also delve into questions about the lawfulness of the program and whether its secrecy is justified. Most impressively, he'll do all of that in about 30 minutes or so. By way of background, Jameel directs the American Civil Liberty Union's Center for Democracy, which houses the ACLU's work on human rights, national security, and speech, privacy, and technology. And currently, Jameel is an Open Society Fellow working on a book about issues relating to official secrecy and individual privacy in the United States since September 11th, 2001. His book draws on his experiences litigating cases concerning the Bush administration's infamous torture memos, the Abu Ghraib torture photos, the U.S. Patriot Act, warrantless wiretapping, and other issues including targeted killings, which he'll be discussing today. So let's get started. We'll keep this pretty informal, and when Jameel is finished, we'll open things up for questions and discussion. So over to you.
Okay. Thanks, Jonathan. So I have about 5 hours of material, and I'm going to try to keep it to 20 minutes so we have time, you know, to have a discussion. I thought I would start by trying to identify some of the unanswered questions or incompletely answered questions about the drone program. And I'm going to use that phrase, the drone program, because everybody uses it. But what I'm really talking about is targeted killing. I'm not talking about drones. Drones are used for many different things, some of them good, some of them bad. I'm really talking about targeted killing. When I use the phrase drone program, I'm talking about the targeted killing program. As everybody knows, since 2001, the U.S. government has killed hundreds, thousands of people using armed drones mainly. In places far removed from actual battlefields. That is something that we know to be true. But there are many things that are murkier. First, it's not entirely clear who it is that the government is killing. That's a difficult question for a number of different reasons. It's difficult because the government doesn't acknowledge specific strikes. It doesn't release the names of the people who have been killed to the extent it knows those names. It doesn't release aggregate casualty numbers. You may remember General Tommy Frank's phrase from the Iraq War, we don't do body counts. That's still true, or it's certainly true that they don't release body counts. And for those reasons, it's difficult to say who precisely it is that the government is killing. That said, there have been a number of claims made by various national security officials about civilian casualties. In June of 2011, John Brennan, who was then the president's chief counterterrorism advisor, said that there had been zero civilian casualties. Senator Feingold, who chairs the Senate Intelligence Committee, said at Brennan's confirmation hearing in February, she said that the number of civilian casualties has been in the single digits. Those claims are pretty clearly false. There was one strike in December of 2009 in Al-Majla in Yemen that killed 41 people, including 21 children and 14 women. The journalist Jeremy Scahill has video footage of the aftermath. There are WikiLeaks cables discussing that particular strike. The Yemeni government first took credit for it or responsibility for it. But then the WikiLeaks cables made clear that it was actually a U.S. strike, and that was just a single strike that caused dozens of civilian casualties, and there have been many, many other strikes that have been well documented in Pakistan and Yemen especially, resulting in civilian casualties. And then there are independent groups that are keeping track of the U.S.'s use of armed drones, and those groups estimate that civilian casualty numbers are in the hundreds. The group that is probably tracking all of this most carefully is called the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. Some of you have worked with them. They're based in the U.K., and they estimate that about 4,300 people have been killed by American armed drones, and of those, about 1,000 were civilians. So there's a chasm between the claims that national security officials are making publicly and the independent research that's out there. So how to explain that difference? Well, one possible explanation for the difference is definitional, because it matters, obviously, how you define. If you're distinguishing between civilians and militants, it depends. It matters how you define militants. And there have been a number of reports indicating that the CIA, at least, uses a very broad definition of militant. There was a New York Times article from May of last year, you probably all read it at the time, that said that the CIA was counting all military-age men in strike zones as combatants, unless there was intelligence posthumously proving that they were innocent. Now, what that means in practice, I'm not entirely sure, but one thing it means is that the CIA is clearly counting some people who ought to be counted as civilians or bystanders as militants. And then just a few weeks ago, the former ambassador to Pakistan, Cameron Munter, said that he was complaining that the CIA in Pakistan had treated every military-aged man who was carrying a gun as a militant. It's hard to know exactly how much weight to give claims like those. Former Obama administration officials have said to me and to some of you that those claims are not true. But there is clearly some sort of definitional game going on that allows the government to say publicly that civilian casualty numbers are very low when all of the evidence that's out there suggests just the opposite. So one unanswered question is, who is it that the government is actually killing? A second unanswered question, which I think is important, is on whose orders are these strikes actually being carried out? President Obama said on Google Plus last year, at Google Plus Hangout last year, he said that the program is on a very tight leash. That was his phrase. But it's not clear to me what that means. To the extent that the CIA and JSOC are using kill lists, it's not clear who makes the decision to add a particular name to the kill list.
JSOC.
Sorry, what did I say?
JSOC.
Joint Special Operations Command. It's a component of the Defense Department, Special Forces. It's the Special Forces, and they, along with the CIA, carry out these targeted killings. So there's a question about who adds the names to the kill list in the first place. And then there's a quick question, once the names are added to the kill list, who is it that decides that a strike can be carried out at any particular point in time? And then there are many news reports that make clear that the government is relying not just on targeted killings in the narrowest sense of that phrase, but also on signature strikes. The government is targeting groups of people because they exhibit certain behavioral signatures. It's a group of men carrying arms, or it's somebody driving a flatbed truck that has a lot of men in the back. And based on certain signatures, the CIA or JSOC will carry out a strike. So who is it that decides what signatures are sufficient to warrant the use of lethal force? So all of that is unclear. And so that's the second unanswered question. Third unanswered question is, where are these killings being carried out? So we know that the government has used armed drones on actual battlefields, for example, in Afghanistan and Iraq. We also know that it's used armed drones and carried out targeted killings in Yemen, Somalia, and Pakistan. But we don't know whether the government has carried out targeted killings in other countries. There was an interview that John Rizzo gave to Newsweek. John Rizzo is the former acting general counsel of the CIA. He gave this interview to Newsweek probably 18 months ago, in which they asked him, where are these drone strikes being carried out? And he didn't actually answer that question, but he said, don't be distracted by drones. The Predator is the weapon of choice, but it could as easily be a bullet to your head. As the former general counsel of the CIA. And so that raises the question, you know, both a question about methods, you know, is the CIA using other methods, not just drones, to carry out these target killings, but also raised for the first time the possibility that the CIA was carrying out these killings in other places. And John Brennan, at his confirmation hearing for CIA director a couple of months ago, was asked directly by, I think, Senator Wyden, where has the CIA carried out these targeted killings? And Brennan declined to answer the question, and he said, if I am confirmed, I will give you, the Senate Intelligence Committee, a list of those countries. So we don't know. We don't have a complete list of the countries in which the CIA has carried out these killings. So that's the third question. Fourth question, this one has got a lot of press over the last few weeks. What's the legal basis for these killings? The government has offered two different theories. One is that the authorization for use of military force that Congress passed in the weeks after 9/11 authorizes it to use lethal force against al-Qaeda and affiliated forces. The second theory is that the U.S. has authority to use military force in self-defense. And those two theories stated at that level of abstraction are not, in my view, objectionable. I think that the government does have some authority under the AOMF to use lethal force, AOMF, the authorization for use of military force, and it does have authority in some circumstances to use military force in self-defense. But that's at a level of abstraction. Once you get to the details, the government's legal argument becomes, I think, a lot more problematic. For example, by its terms, the AOMF requires a link to 9/11. The AOMF was authorized the use of military force against the people who planned or authorized or aided the 9/11 attacks. And the government is now using lethal force against many groups that had nothing to do with 9/11 and in fact didn't even exist when the 9/11 attacks were carried out. That's true of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, it's true of the Shabaab in Somalia. Many of the people that the government is targeting don't obviously fall within the scope of the AOMF. A second problem is that while the government does have the authority to use military force in self-defense, ordinarily self-defense is limited to threats that are imminent. And the government is plainly using lethal force against people who present no imminent threat at all, and sometimes who present no threat to the United States. They're actually engaged not in some global conflict, but in local conflicts. And so it's not obvious how these two legal theories that the government has at least gestured towards. It's not obvious how those legal theories actually justify the program as it exists in practice. There was a white paper that was leaked, a Justice Department white paper that was leaked to NBC News a couple of months ago, and that white paper sets out, I think in more detail than it had been set out previously, the government's two legal theories, or its legal theory based on these two different sources of authority. One thing that's notable about the white paper is while it alludes to this imminence requirement, it defines imminence very, very broadly. So imminence, a person is deemed to be an imminent threat or can be deemed to be an imminent threat, even if there's no reason to believe that the threat is immediate, and even if there is no reason to believe that the person is engaged in any specific plot. And so the Justice Department uses the phrase continuing threat. The framework is imminence, but they define imminence by reference to the concept of a continuing threat. And so they accept imminence only really by gutting the idea. So that's one, in my view, one problem with the white paper. Another problem with the white paper is that the white paper is focused entirely on people who are thought to be senior leaders of al-Qaeda. The entire white paper is an argument that the government is justified in targeting people who are senior leaders. But the program, as we know it, does not target only senior leaders. You know, we have, again, killed 4,300 people. Senator Lindsey Graham said a few weeks ago it was 4,700 people. killed some, 4,000, 5,000 people. They can't all be senior leaders of Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. And there was a report out by Stanford Law School and NYU clinics, came out maybe 3 or 4 months ago, that estimated that only 2% of the people who have been killed in Pakistan could fairly be described as high-profile targets. And so even if you accept everything that the white paper says as true, the white paper is a defense of a program quite different from the one that actually exists. So that's the white paper. That's the issue of legal authority. So those are my four unanswered questions. First one has to do with who it is that we're killing. Second one has to do with where we are killing those people. The third is on whose orders are we killing people, and the fourth is on what legal authority. But that's just to say that there are a lot of unanswered questions about the program, and there's a lot of distance between the program that the government is defending and the program as it exists on the ground. So I said I was going to talk about litigation. In an effort to get more information about what it is that the government is doing, the ACLU has filed two different lawsuits under the Freedom of Information Act. One we filed back in 2010 in Washington, in D.C. It's a relatively broad request. It includes a request for information about civilian casualties. The other FOIA request we filed after a strike in Yemen, or two strikes in Yemen, killed three U.S. citizens in September and October of 2011. So one of them was Anwar al-Awlaki, who was actually targeted by the CIA. A second U.S. citizen was killed with him, Samir Khan. And 2 weeks later, the CIA killed Anwar al-Awlaki's 16-year-old son, Abdulrahman al-Awlaki, in a separate strike 400 miles away from the earlier one. So those three U.S. citizens were killed in a matter of a month in Yemen. And after those strikes, we filed a second Freedom of Information Act request and eventually a lawsuit to enforce that request, asking for, among other things, the legal memos underlying the program, including legal memos relating to the government's authority to kill U.S. citizens. So two separate requests, two separate lawsuits. The government's response, to the extent we were asking for information about agencies other than the CIA, the government's response was, this information is covered by, is classified and can't be released without jeopardizing national security, and therefore we are withholding it. That was the government's argument with respect to information, for example, from the Defense Department. With respect to the CIA, the government's argument was a little bit different. The government said, we can't even acknowledge that the CIA has any role in a targeted killing program. We can't confirm that the CIA has any documents. We can't confirm that there is such a program. It's called a Glomar response because 30 years ago there was a case in D.C. involving a ship called the Glomar Explorer that the CIA didn't want to confirm was its ship. And the D.C. Circuit upheld the CIA's non-response to a FOIA request. The CIA had said, we can't confirm this is our ship, we can't confirm we have any documents about it. And the D.C. Circuit said, in these circumstances, it's okay for the CIA to give that kind of non-response. And so the CIA gave us the same kind of non-response. They said, we can't acknowledge that there is such a targeted killing program, and we can't acknowledge that we have any documents relating to it. That argument and the other argument from other agencies about national security preventing the disclosure of information about the program, those arguments were accepted both by the district court in New York and by the district court in D.C. In New York, the district court was conflicted about accepting the government's argument, but did ultimately accept it. There was a sentence from a couple sentences from the district court's opinion in New York that got picked up by a lot of the news stories, and I'll read them for you. So the judge upholds the CIA's non-response and then says, I can find no way around the thicket of laws and precedents that effectively allow the executive branch of our government to proclaim as perfectly lawful certain actions that seem on their face incompatible with our Constitution, while keeping the reasons for their conclusion a secret. The Alice in Wonderland nature of this pronouncement is not lost on me. So that's what she says, but then she goes on to affirm the CIA's non-response to the request. The district court in D.C. also accepted the CIA's Glomar response. But just a couple of weeks ago, the D.C. Circuit, the appeals court, overturned that ruling. The key sentence from the D.C. Circuit's ruling was this one. In this case, the CIA asked the courts to stretch the Glomar doctrine too far, to give their imprimatur to a fiction of deniability that no reasonable person would regard as plausible. And that's obviously true. At this point, it's not plausible that the CIA doesn't have a role in the targeted killing program. So much has been said publicly about it, not only by third parties, but by the government itself. And that was the argument we made to the court, and we were gratified when the D.C. Circuit accepted it. That said, the D.C. Circuit's decision is very narrow. It requires the CIA to do is acknowledge the existence of a program that everybody already knows exists. And so the implications of the ruling may not be dramatic. But one thing that the CIA now has to do is process the FOIA request just like it would have had to process any other FOIA request. And that means explaining what information it has about the program and providing a justification for keeping it secret or releasing it. So that is a step forward. It's a small step forward, but it's a step forward. As anyone who has litigated Freedom of Information Act suits knows, sometimes the government's explanations for keeping things secret can themselves be valuable. When we litigated the torture cases a few years ago, one of the most valuable things that we got from the CIA was an index of the documents that it possessed about the destruction of videotapes. And from that index, we were able to assemble a narrative about when the tapes were created, when they were destroyed, who authorized the destruction. They didn't release any documents, but they released an index of the documents, and the index itself was useful. Whether we get a useful index in this case, we'll have to see. But it's a possibility because of the D.C. Circuit's decision. So I want to stop very shortly, but I want to say one more thing. Concerns about the lawfulness of the program have led a number of people now to ask whether the court should be playing more of a role in either assessing the lawfulness of the framework under which these strikes are being carried out, or assessing the lawfulness of individual strikes. Responses to that proposal fall into three categories. John Yoo and the Obama administration have argued that the courts should play no role at all. The argument is that the courts should not second guess the executive's targeting decisions during wartime, and that indeed it would be unconstitutional for courts to do so. Ironically, many of the Obama administration officials who are making this argument now were making exactly the opposite argument when the Bush administration was proposing that the courts had no role to play in second-guessing the government's detention decisions. But those officials have now switched sides and are arguing that the court should stay out of it. The second possible response, which comes from people like Senator Feinstein, Jane Harman, David Cole, is that that Congress should establish a specialized drone court to oversee the targeted killing program. And I think that proposal comes from a good place. I think that it recognizes that the courts have a role to play. The ACLU hasn't endorsed that proposal for a couple of reasons. First, we're not convinced that a court that is reviewing strikes before they take place is likely to be a significant check on executive action. It's more likely just to, as the FISA court does, rubber stamp things that the executive would have done on its own anyway. So that's one thing. We're just not confident that a court playing a role before strikes are carried out will actually serve as a meaningful check. And the second thing is, it only makes sense to propose before the fact judicial review if you think that there will be time for it, right? And to propose that the court has that role to play is to accept that the government has the authority to use lethal force against people who don't pose imminent threats. Because if you're talking only about people who pose imminent threats, by definition, prior judicial review is infeasible. So the drone court proposal is sort of the implicit premise in the drone court proposal is that the government has authority to target people who don't present imminent threats, and that's not a premise that we at the ACLU have accepted. The final possible response to this drone, to the judicial review proposal, is the one that that we have been making at the ACLU, and that's that the court should play a role after the fact. That once a strike is carried out, family members can go into court and challenge the lawfulness of the strike. Now, there's something that is obviously unsatisfactory about that kind of judicial review, because it's by definition too late. The person who is who's been targeted has already been killed. But it doesn't raise any of the separation of powers concerns that that have been raised by people in the Obama administration. It doesn't raise the concern about a court overseeing the government's targeting decisions. And it's the way that the courts already deal with wrongful death suits inside the United States. If the police kill somebody in New York because they think he's waving a gun around, the remedy is family members can go into court and challenge the lawfulness of the police's action. And again, that is obviously unsatisfactory in a very obvious way, but it does create a legal framework that operates prospectively to cabin the government's authority and to create incentives and disincentives where they should be created. It's also the way that courts have been dealing with national security detention. In D.C., there are district courts that routinely now review the government's justification for detaining people who are held at Guantanamo. They review the evidence. They ask whether the government had the legal authority to detain the person. They ask whether the government's evidence was sufficient. That's exactly the same kind of task the courts would have to do in with respect to targeted killing. And there is, in fact, a lawsuit already pending. The ACLU and and CCR have brought a suit on behalf of the three U.S. citizens who were killed in Yemen. The case is pending in D.C. right now in a district court in D.C., and it seeks exactly that kind of after-the-fact judicial review. So those are the three options that are out there right now. I think we'll see that judicial review question resolved over the next few months. A final point I want to make just very quickly is that, you know, I've talked mainly about the law, and the law is important here, but I also think that, and Lisa and I were talking about this a few days ago, there's some danger in if you just have a legal argument, there's some danger in losing the forest for the trees. You know, if you step back, what's going on here is we've killed hundreds of people whose identities we don't know, in countries we can't name, on the basis of standards that are secret, on the basis of evidence that has never been presented to a court. And I think you don't need to be a legal genius to understand that there's something wrong with that. It's inconceivable to me that people would be so complacent about this policy if this policy were being proposed by the Bush administration. The reason it's being accepted is that people trust President Obama, they trust John Brennan, they trust Harold Coe. Whether that trust is well placed or not is, you know, other people can decide. But those people are not going to be, and already Harold Coe has left, right? But those people are not going to be the ones with their fingers on the trigger forever. There will be other people in their positions, and those people will have the same power that we have given to President Obama and John Brennan. And that power will be used not just with respect to Al-Qaeda, but with respect to the next group in the next war, and it'll be used in other countries and with other methods, not just drones. And you have to ask whether this power that we are now investing in the executive branch is actually cabinable. Once you give it to them, you know, where is the stopping point? And that power will be used by other countries as well. It's already being used, China has already contemplated using it. In one case, although I think at the last minute it decided not to. And there were, as everybody knows, targeted killings in the 1980s and 1990s. In Washington, D.C., there was a Chilean dissident who was killed by the Pinochet regime. We prosecuted the people who carried it out. When Alexander Litvinenko was killed in London in 2006, we called it a crime, and it was a crime. What will we say the next time something like that happens? So I think the legal argument is important, but the legal argument is only a small piece of this. I think I'll stop there, and hopefully I haven't used up all the time. Okay.
Well disciplined. Thank you. That was a great sort of drive through the various issues that the drone program pose, I would say, to the American public, to the countries that they're used in, as well abroad. I will open up for questions. I just want to mention your four unanswered questions, I think, are a great template that President Obama should follow to fulfill what Attorney General Holder said a few weeks or months ago, when he said that President Obama heard the calls for transparency about the drone program and will answer them. We don't know what that answer is going to look like, but if they could answer a good chunk of the questions you pose, I think that would be a great contribution. Wishful thinking, perhaps, but we'll see. We'll see what happens. I had one question, maybe to start things off from, and then we'll get straight to questions from all of you, which is, where do you see things going from here, from a litigation advocacy strategy, from a non-litigation advocacy strategy? And just to sort of sweeten the pot, 2014, U.S. troops supposedly, a big bulk of them moving out of Afghanistan. How does that affect the landscape of the discussion around this issue?
Well, I think to answer the last part of your question, I think that there is this question of what the connection is between the drawdown of troops in Afghanistan and the government's authority to rely on the AUMF. And I think that there are many people in the Obama administration who are rightfully anxious about their authority to use lethal force, in some sense, running out because of the drawdown of troops in Afghanistan. The truth is that whether that connection actually holds, whether the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan means that the government can no longer rely on the AUMF or decides no longer to rely on the AUMF is more of a political question than a legal question. I don't think that there is a strong legal argument. I don't think that it dramatically changes the government's legal arguments. I think the legal arguments that they've been making, to the extent that they are persuasive, and again, I'm not one who's been persuaded by them, but to the extent they're persuasive, I think they'll continue to be persuasive after the drawdown. I think the question is whether we can, whether human rights groups and anti-war groups can use the end of the war in Afghanistan as an opportunity to persuade the administration that it's time to declare an end to the broader war and to rely, to the extent there are imminent threats, the government will continue to have self-defense authority to address them. It's not going to leave the government without any power, but it will mean declaring an end to a war that the government has not yet been willing to declare an end to.
Who would like to begin? Please go ahead.
So I mentioned that I was probably going to ask, but there's been recently a publicized, so it might have been from prior time, but there's a publicized push apparently to move the targeted killings drone program completely out of the realm of CIA jurisdiction into DOD jurisdiction. And I'm wondering what that means in practical aspects for those of us who do work on human rights issues in terms of transparency and later down the road in terms of accountability. Is retroactive transparency a possibility? Is this in actuality actually going to change anything? Are we still not going to know as much in terms of the arguments? Mm-hmm. What legally does that change from a government standpoint to those of us working on these issues?
I think those are good questions. I don't know the answer. I mean, my colleague Chris Anders, who is our lobbyist on these issues at the ACLU, he has a piece in The Guardian, I think it went up yesterday, about precisely those questions, about what significance there is in the possibility that the program will be moved from the CIA to DOD. I think that it creates the possibility of more transparency. It doesn't guarantee that there will be more transparency. It creates the possibility of a narrower program. It doesn't guarantee that there will be a narrower program. We did advocate one thing that many people say is that part of the reason the program expanded so dramatically is that there was a kind of competition between the two agencies to be the one carrying out strikes in any particular place or against any particular group. I don't know if that's true or not, but if it is true, then moving it to a single agency will resolve that problem. At the end of the day, what matters most is not whose finger is on the trigger, but, under what circumstances they're actually pulling the trigger. And I don't think that simply moving the program is going to guarantee that the program is narrower. It's possible that moving the program is an indication that the administration is committed to narrowing the program and to more transparency around it, but that remains to be seen.
I've got two questions.
Yeah, please.
I'll be succinct. My first one is, what kind of consequences would you expect / desire from these post-targeted killing hearings? Mm-hmm. As you said, it would be too late to, I mean, morally, but yeah. Like, what would you hope would come out of a wrongful targeted killing? And my second question would be, I mean, just to play a little devil's advocate, what kind of information in a classified project would you be expecting / want before it happens or even after it happens? And I guess because of the nature of it being classified, because of the nature of these targeted killings, like, have to be approved by someone, there's already, I'm assuming, a chain of command when they make these decisions. What kind of information would you want from that system?
Mm-hmm. So on the first question, this question about what we're asking for in the after the fact suits, just because of the way American constitutional law works, they're damages suits against government officials who are alleged to have violated the Constitution. The chances of actually getting damages from senior officials who authorize these strikes, the chances are pretty slim. The suit, though, is meant to, in order to reach that point, though, a court is going to have to analyze the scope of the government's legal authority. And if a court does that, then it has created rules that will apply to the government going forward. And if the court finds that the government violated the Constitution, as we allege in this particular case, it also creates something that many victims of these policies care a lot about, which is an acknowledgement of wrongdoing. And, it's a small thing. A judge can't resurrect people who have been killed unlawfully. But having talked to many people who are affected by the program and also talked to many people who are affected by the CIA's torture program, a lot of them care deeply about an official acknowledgement of wrongdoing, that it would mean something to them. So there are those possibilities. There is a legislative proposal that has been floated by some law professors that would essentially move the damages obligation from individual officials to the government itself. We haven't said anything, the ACLU hasn't said anything publicly about that proposal, but I personally think it's a good idea. I think that it's, ultimately these are decisions that are being made by the government, not by individuals. It seems fairer, and it seems fairer to make the government be on the hook for it rather than make senior officials be on the hook for it. So it's possible that kind of legislation will actually get introduced, and maybe it'll go somewhere. I think it's a good idea. The same legislation would make it, would preempt the state secrets privilege, which is something that the government has relied on in cases like this, and it would prevent the government from relying on that doctrine to quash these kinds of cases. And this sort of goes to your question about classification. It's true a lot of the information here is classified. We don't think it should be classified. To the extent that the government is classifying information about intelligence sources and methods, that's one thing. But what the government is classifying here is not just that. It's classifying legal arguments. Even after strikes are carried out, it's classifying factual information that it would have had to introduce in court had it charged any of these people with crimes. In a way, it creates a kind of perverse incentive for the government to kill people rather than try them, because if they try them, they have to introduce this evidence. You can't try somebody on the basis of evidence that's never introduced in court. But if you kill somebody, the government says, we don't have to introduce that evidence in court. I'm not saying that the government is choosing to kill people rather than try them, although this does create that kind of incentive structure.
Tony Wilson, National Security Human Rights Campaign. In your opinion, do you think that if there's a new AUMF, so let's say Congress passes a new AUMF, then the president can target anyone who's a terrorist based on some criteria or no criteria at all anywhere in the world. Does that fundamentally change like the litigation and the advocacy and just in the general environment, or is it kind of, you know, doesn't really change anything at all, or for the ACLU's work or for the kind of field in general?
Well, I mean, I think it would change the arguments. You know, part of our argument right now is that the AOMF doesn't extend to some of the strikes that the government is carrying out. And Congress could make that argument go away by enacting a new AOMF. You know, my impression is that there aren't many people in the Obama administration who are actually that keen on a new AOMF, and the call is coming from Ben Wittes and Bobby Chesney and Jack Goldsmith, people who are supportive of many of the administration's national security policies but have a different agenda. And I think that there are people in the Obama administration who do want this program to be subject to some kinds of, to some real limits. And they said this, I think, pretty forthrightly, that they're concerned about what another administration might do with the power that they have now claimed. And I think that they ought to be concerned. So maybe this proposal for a new AOMF will go somewhere, but if it does, I don't think it'll go somewhere because the Obama administration is really that keen on it. And so far, I don't think there's anybody, to put it crassly, I don't think there's anybody they wanted to kill who they couldn't find some legal argument to, you know, who's killing they couldn't find some legal argument to justify. So... one of the things that's complicated about the AOMF is, you know, the current AOMF is vague enough that the Supreme Court has said it has to be read against international law. And so the arguments about the meaning of the AOMF are really arguments about international law. People argue about what IHL requires, what it doesn't require, or they argue about, when is there an armed conflict under international law. If Congress were to enact a much more specific AOMF that conflicted with international law, I don't know how we would deal with that. I don't know how the courts would deal with that. Maybe there would be a supremacy clause argument against the AOMF in that situation, but it would. I think it would make litigation on this issue much much more difficult, and it's already quite difficult.
I may just have a follow-up question to both the last two questions that were asked, which is, given the history of some of the U.S. courts' interpretations and acceptance of associated forces, the decision in Holder in relation to humanitarian assistance providers, how well are U.S. judges doing at correctly interpreting international humanitarian law? In such a way that if you did get the issue of post-targeting assessments or post-strike assessments in front of them, that they would even be capable of providing us with a type of interpretation that we're comfortable with.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any guarantee that we would get an interpretation that we're comfortable with. I mean, I think that the Supreme Court, you know, in the few cases in which it actually assessed the AOMF, cases like Hamdi, the Supreme Court, you know, those decisions are seen as, in general, human rights friendly decisions. But the Supreme Court has for the most part, stayed out of this. Except to make the decision that the lower courts had the authority and the obligation to hear habeas petitions filed by detainees at Guantanamo. The Supreme Court, since Boumediene, has stayed out of these questions altogether. And the D.C. Circuit has been essentially left in charge. And the D.C. Circuit has been quite generous to the Bush administration and the Obama administration in interpreting the AOMF. So if the D.C. Circuit is the court that's going to make these decisions, I think that's a problem for us. But having judges involved at least creates the possibility of resistance to these policies. And without judges involved, there's not even that, you know, that possibility. So we're arguing for judicial oversight for that reason.
This is Lisa Magarill, also from the National Security and Human Rights Campaign. I was curious that you said you saw that the question of judicial review would be resolved fairly soon. You said within a few months. Do you really think, that sort of the assessment, that things are moving that quickly?
No, I didn't mean to say that it would be resolved in the next few months. I think it'll unfold over the next few months. What I understand is that Senator Feinstein, who at one point had proposed the drone court, is now having second thoughts about whether that's the best idea. Now there is this movement among some law professors to push this after-the-fact judicial review, which again, I think is a better idea. While it has its fundamental flaw, I think it's a better idea than a drone court that exists solely to review, death warrants or proposed death warrants. So I think it'll play out, in Congress over the next few months, or begin playing out in Congress over the next few months. And then meanwhile, there's this litigation in D.C. in which a court is being asked to do, exactly what I was discussing, after-the-fact judicial review. We'll see how the court responds to that. So these legal arguments and litigation is just a small piece of this. And ultimately, I don't think that these decisions are going to be made because courts order the government to do one thing or another. I think the litigation can influence the debate, but it's the larger political debate that matters. And that political debate is influenced by all sorts of things, right? It's influenced by the drawdown of troops in Afghanistan. It's influenced by elections. It's influenced by media reports about civilian casualties. It's influenced by Rand Paul's filibuster. It's very difficult to predict, when the public will get excited about any particular issue or upset about any particular issue. Very difficult to predict how these big institutions like Congress or the courts will respond to those things when they happen. At the ACLU, I think what we're trying to do is, lay the groundwork so there's the possibility of institutions doing the right things when those opportunities happen to come up. But I feel like we have control over a very small number of these factors.
Can I just follow up? I mean, I think one of the really interesting issues around the drones debate is that it, in a way, it connects to Guantanamo and to the administration's reluctance to let some people go. And so I'm just curious how you see this connection. I mean, how you define the legal basis for drone targeting also connects to how you justify continuing to hold people under law of war, detention, or in some other context. So I wonder if you see the two problems as linked and what the advocacy strategy around that needs to be. Separate? Very separate, because there's a little more momentum on drones, or does it need to recognize that connection?
Yeah, I definitely don't have a complete answer to that question. The two issues are linked for many reasons. One of the reasons they're linked is that the government is relying on the AUMF in both situations, and so the question of the scope of the AUMF comes up in both situations. Now, whether the government's authority to detain is the same as its authority to kill, in other words, does it have the same authority to kill people that it has to detain them, I think is a complicated question and not one that any court has yet had to resolve. But as for our advocacy strategy, I guess I have given up a little bit on trying to drive the debate, and instead am spending more time thinking about how to take advantage of whatever it is that people are talking about right now. I think that Rand Paul's filibuster, for all of its flaws, and there are many flaws, did create an opportunity to bring attention to the scope of the claim that the government was making, the possible abuses of this authority, the possibility of judicial oversight. There are all sorts of things that we were able to talk about because Rand Paul had got people's attention. The leak of the white paper to NBC News was another such opportunity. The John Brennan's confirmation hearing provided another opportunity. And there was a time when we at the ACLU used to spend a lot of energy trying to keep people on one topic for a long time, or saying that, you know, over the next 3 months we're going to make progress on Guantanamo specifically. And, you know, to some extent we still try to do that, but I think we've shifted a little bit towards being more responsive rather than proactive in that particular sense.
So we have time for one or two more questions.
I have a question.
Yeah, please.
For the Soros Economic Development Fund, how complicated does your life get when governments like Pakistan, you know, they don't admit it, but have given permission for drone strikes for the United States to kill Pakistani citizens at the U.S.'s, well, there's some collusion there, but that's happening. How much does that complicate what you do? And second, how much of an opportunity is that to go at this by getting at the Pakistani government for allowing the killing of its own citizens without any court or any case?
Right. Well, you know, for a long time, it wasn't obvious to me why the government wouldn't release the OLC memos. You know, they were willing to say so much about their legal analysis publicly. You know, this white paper that they gave to Congress is also an extensive legal analysis, and it wasn't obvious to me why they weren't releasing the memos themselves. It's still not obvious to me why they're not releasing the memos themselves, but one of the arguments they've made is that the memos apparently name specific countries, and to release the memos would, I guess, because the naming of the countries is so intertwined with the legal analysis, the releasing the memos would require them to break promises that they've made to foreign intelligence services, because they have guaranteed other countries that they will keep these secrets. Now, I have a lot of questions about that. It doesn't seem plausible to me that the names of countries really are so intertwined with the legal analysis or so intertwined with other documents that they refuse to release. I don't see why they can't just redact that information and provide us the rest of it. But then there's another, there's sort of a more fundamental question, which is, should the government be making these promises to other countries? Should the government be saying to Yemen and Pakistan, yes, we will keep it secret that we are carrying out strikes in your countries? And it may be true that there are costs to not allowing the government to make those kinds of promises, but there are also costs to allowing the government to make those kinds of promises. And one cost is that the American public doesn't know in which countries the government is at war, right? The government is using military force in some number of countries that we don't know, and that's a cost to this kind of secrecy. One of the frustrating things about litigating these issues is that there is no mechanism in American law by which some institution other than the executive branch can weigh those costs. There's no mechanism that allows somebody independent of the executive branch to say, well, it may be that there are costs to this kind of openness, but the benefits to this kind of openness outweigh those costs. Now, I suppose one answer is, well, the political process is the balancing. You know, American citizens will decide. If they don't like the secrecy, they're going to complain about it, and they're going to get rid of people who are executive branch officials who are overly reticent, and they're going to elect people who promise to be transparent. But that argument, I think, goes only so far, because you don't know what you're not being told, and you don't know in which countries the government is at war. And part of, it's deep secrecy. David Posen, who's a professor at Columbia, has this great article about this kind of secrecy, where you don't know what you don't know. He calls it deep secrecy. And this kind of deep secrecy is not really something that can be addressed through the kind of political process that I was just describing. If we don't know what we don't know, then it's difficult to hold people accountable. So, you know, that's just a long way of saying that, for better or worse, I think worse, nobody is actually weighing the cost of that kind of secrecy against the benefits, if there are benefits to it.
So we're at the 1 hour mark. Unless there are any extremely pressing questions, I'll probably want to end it here and give a big thank you to Jamil. I think the end discussion about the linkages between the US, other governments that it's operating in, really exposes the complexity of the debate and the responsibilities of, say, the Pakistan government or Pakistan civil society and the US government and US civil society on engaging on all these issues, as well as all the other countries we do and don't know about. So thank you for all joining us, and thank you, Jamil. Appreciate it.